Hello, friends, and welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio. Thanks for listening. Hey, if you love my podcast and you want to show your support, please go to tomrhodesradio.com and you can become a premium member for only two little old dollars a month. And hey, honestly, how many free grapes are you going to eat at the grocery store before you finally buy a bunch? Show your support. I really don't want to have commercials on my podcast for products I don't believe in and dumbass shit that I don't want on my podcast. I thought you could show your support because you love my podcast, and you know you do. Please visit tomrhodesradio.com. You're going to love it. And I'll keep bringing you fabulous episodes like today's episode with Lynn Ruth Miller. Lynn Ruth Miller is a risk taker. She believes in following your dreams. And she's 81 years old. I first met Lynn Ruth 10 years ago. She started being a stand-up comedian at 71 years old in San Francisco. She came to see me perform at the Purple Onion, the famous old place where Lenny Bruce and Woody Allen, all these people played. And I met her then. Shortly thereafter, she hooked me up with a gig at Stanford University, and I've been friends with her ever since. I love Lynn Ruth. She has so much wisdom and insight from life lessons learned. And you know, she's so old, she will not bullshit you. And that's what I love about the thing about getting old. The best part seems to be being able to say whatever the fuck you want to say. And that's Lynn Ruth Miller. She's an amazing story. I didn't realize how epic her life had been. She's done 9 Edinburgh Fringe Festivals. This podcast was recorded in Edinburgh. And I saw her show, her one-woman show, in Edinburgh, and it's just unbelievable what this woman has lived through and how much life and knowledge and goodness she has. She's inspiring. She's someone I love to talk to, and I wish I was related to her, and I kind of feel like I am, because she pops up all over the world, and she'll be sitting in my audience, and I'll see her, and she performs all over the world. Last year, she left San Francisco and moved to Brighton, England to follow her dream. I don't know where you are in the world, what your dream is, but Lynn Ruth Miller was ballsy enough to take the chance and move to England, and she's an inspiring person. I love her to death, and it is my pleasure to present to you now the one and only Lynn Ruth Miller. Talking about love, God, talking about love. Lynn Ruth Miller, ladies and gentlemen, Lynn Ruth Miller.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hello, my friend. I was thrilled that I saw your one-woman show here.
I was thrilled that you came. It's so different than anything you've seen of me. You only see the wisecracks.
I've only seen you do jokes and, you know, little like one-liners and,
that's right,
you know.
That's what I do.
I had no idea you had experienced so much
in your life. Well, we all do, my love. You have as well.
Well, I mean, you're 80 years old. Certainly,
81. You've almost 81.
Almost 81.
October 11th. I'll be.
What year were you born?
1933.
Holy shit!
I know, long time.
Wow.
We did have flush toilets. We did.
Wow, you were 10 when the war was raging.
Yeah, I was 8.
So you remember the whole thing?
World War II.
Yeah.
Of course I do.
But I mean, it was raging when you were 10.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was awful. I remember when where we were sitting when Franklin Delano Roosevelt went on the radio. We all sat around the radio, no television, and my mother was holding the baby. My sister had just been born, the little bitch, and he said, you know, on December 7th, 1941, right? Somebody was maliciously attacked at Pearl Harbor, and it was
Will stand in infamy.
Yeah, that this day, no, the day for infamy was that Roosevelt? I thought it was Churchill.
No, that was Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, yeah. This day will go out down in infamy, and I remember how loyal we were to Roosevelt, and how when I see the movies about him, he was God. He was God to us.
Got everybody through the Depression.
Right. Well, he did. I remember I was born in the Depression.
So did you see that? What was it? Hudson on the, where he was like getting blowjobs from his cousin or something?
Yeah, he was getting it on with everyone despite his legs. I thought you needed your legs, but I guess just women do.
It's all about the hips.
Yeah.
It's all about the hips.
Anyway, yeah, we thought he was God. And Eleanor Roosevelt was like a princess. We just thought she was so magnificent. And there was no questioning of the motive, the value of the war or what we were doing. And the racism was disgusting, obnoxiously horrible. And years later, I was reading, I think it was Our Hearts Were Young and Gay by Cornelia Otis Skinner. And there was another one, Chicken Every Sunday. That was just a bestseller at the time it came out. And when I was reading it aloud in the 80s, the early 80s, I was appalled at how racist it was.
What do you mean racist against?
Someone who was German who had been living for years in your town would be stoned.
Wow.
It wasn't so bad for the Italians. I don't know how the Italians got away with it. I guess because of all that good food. But whatever it was. But the Germans and the Japanese and... Remember, in California, they
put the Japanese in the internment.
They put them in camps.
Yeah.
And I can still remember in grade school, there was a little girl named Hidemi Takeshita. All of a sudden, we had a little Japanese girl, which, of course, everybody hated, in our class. She was brilliant. She was brilliant. And I found out later when I did a research article about the war and what happened in California. Her father had been taking a bus from San Francisco to San Jose when Pearl Harbor was attacked. When he got off the bus in San Jose, he was arrested. He was Japanese. That's all he did that
just
was wrong.
Arrested.
That was it.
Wow.
He was a professor. He was a professor at Stanford.
Wow.
And that's how we got Hidemi, because the mother sent them there. And during the war, we got, and people thought this was all right. That's why when you say to me, how do you like now? I love now. At least we see how disgusting this is. We may still do it, but at least we've got a little moral ping when we say, oh, that's awful to do. My mother and my aunt didn't buy. They got two Japanese women to be their maids.
Wow.
Yeah, a Bessie Mizoguchi.
So you're not one of these people who thinks that the life was better back and you're not.
Oh, no, it was horrible.
Yeah.
It was racist. Life was, what you earned was the most important thing. People were narrow-minded. My mother, you saw my show. My mother would never, of course, my mother was pretty stupid, but my mother would never have, with the programs that we have now, it substitutes for parenting is the most important thing you can do in this world. And parenting is what, if good parents make good society. If you have, I'll never forget this one friend of mine that I do a horrible joke about. I'm glad she's never heard it. who said the parents create sibling rivalry, but parents also create insecurity. They create the need for aggression. They create the need for you to be better than someone else. If you listen to my show, what I said to you is we're all equal. We really are, Tom. We're all equal. We all have different talents, different things. You didn't come to the second show. I've got a quote I love. It's do what you love and do it with all your heart, and you did it. And that's why I think I just value you so much, because you said, what were you, 14 or 15 or 16? You said, I'm going to do this.
Well, I decided when I was 12 I wanted to be a comedian, and I started when I was 17.
And you did it.
But I actually started in high school, like at 15, 16, I was hosting pep rallies and talent shows and that. So I was already starting.
But you knew, but you weren't afraid not to do the other things.
Yeah.
I was. That's why it took me so long. I started when I was 71.
When you had a different world. I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, like you're older than my mother. Not by much. My mom's 75. But I mean, that world
time the pill had come in. Remember about, we were, one of the favorite jokes was, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? I know. And that's the shadow. Yeah, I know. The fear of being pregnant was huge.
Right.
I mean, just really huge. And we never talked about sex, ever, ever. You can't imagine my surprise on my wedding night. We had a wedding. What? What are you doing? Who knew?
Did you really lose your virginity in a hotel in Indiana?
I was a virgin until I got married. Well, you listen to this.
I know, but you said in your show you lost your virginity in a hotel.
A motel in Indiana on plastic sheets, so we slid around a lot.
Why was it plastic sheets?
Don't ask, because the motel didn't want, I don't know what, I didn't ask the motel manager. I was too appalled at what that guy did to me.
Wow, on your wedding night.
Oh, and don't forget, and then you're saying nothing is out of bounds. It was always the woman's fault. It was always the woman's fault if it wasn't good. Who knew? I mean, I had no idea what any of this was about. But for me, the good life that was pounded into me and told to me, and when I didn't do it, reminded all the time, was to find a man who could support me, have two children, and money, and live a life. My mother was my father's badge. She was gorgeous. She was a bitch, but she was little redhead, blue eyes. She didn't look like me. She was really gorgeous. She was an adorable little lady. And he was very homely. And he just loved having her on his arm. Bought her all these fur coats that they murdered little animals. And everything I don't believe in, my parents lived that life. And my sister leads that life now.
Really?
Yeah, total. Lives in Tampa, Florida. She had that surgery, that thing where they cut your stomach in half because she was so fat.
Wow.
Oh, she was huge. And she's done nothing with her life. How do I explain it? Because you haven't done it. I haven't lived it. But it's this life that's centered on what people think and achieving what you see in the media as success. And then saying, they never say to themselves like Patty Page, is this all there is? I have discovered, and believe me, the recipe is not what I expected, but I'm really happy. With this, I'm really happy. My God, I have the best days ever. Ever.
Did you dream about being an entertainer when you were younger?
No,
or that just
no.
never even crossed your mind?
I dreamt about having babies, and of course I didn't know how you did them. I thought that it came from, I thought it was either from the belly button or from God. I didn't know how you got
them. So your first husband wasn't a good lover? He wasn't?
Oh, he was terrible. And then they didn't have any R&R in those days.
What's
so
that?
He came out of Korea. You know,
oh.
Yeah, oh, and then, you know, you give him trouble, he just gave me the back of his hand.
Wow.
And when I said to my mother, I said, you know, he hit me. She said, well, you probably deserved it. I said, well, probably I did.
Jesus, like being livestock.
No, but listen, I probably did, I said. Yeah.
Wow, really?
Can you? And I mean, that's not the person you know. That was the person I was.
Just subservient to...
Well, I wasn't subservient, no. I was always mad. This is wrong. But I mean, I just thought this was what life was. And I didn't like it. And I was very much a reader. I was very much, I read.
So you were reading like D.H. Lawrence novels?
I read all of
it. Why isn't my husband like this?
Yeah, but
this
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
No, what do you mean like this? I didn't know what they were doing. I read The Sun Also Rises, which is about he's lost his dick. He's lost his balls. He's been castrated.
Mm.
And I never understood what his problem was. And it's very clearly delineated in The Sun Also Rises. But I didn't know what they were talking about. And when they said they were going to be living in a hotel together, and it was Roberto, I think, is the guy that was castrated, and she was going to be with another man, I didn't understand why there would be anything wrong with that. I was 19.
Well,
I didn't know. So you learn about the world, and you learn that what people label as evil, because I don't know, you grew up around fundamentals.
Yeah, a lot of them.
Ah, this is totally, because Jews are also fundamentalists, the really religious Jews.
Yeah, they're
like
ultra-Orthodox.
Oh, they're nuts. They tell you things are a sin that are just being human.
Right.
When they asked me, on the woman's hour, they said, because I throw incontinence pads in this one thing. She said, why are you being so outrageous? I said, nothing human is outrageous. We make it outrageous, and then we push it and subvert it, and then people go out and kill each other. That's why I love comedy, because I can say something like that, and no one's going to stone me. Speaking of getting stoned, I've never done that either.
Never smoked pot. Even what, when the 60s, what, were you in your 30s?
I was fighting the hospital. I was in the hospital when I was 36, but I was fighting the eating disorder from the time that I married, which was 20.
And this is gay. Husband number two was gay and only lasted 3 months.
But I can't believe
I'm watching your show there now. I can't believe this is this woman that I've known for yeah, 10 years.
It looks so frivolous and so nothing. Yeah.
I thought maybe you had like a wealthy husband because, you know, you're always popping up in exotic places. You know, I met you in San Francisco. I see you in London. We're in Edinburgh. I'm like, oh, well, you know, maybe her and her husband had a big, long life and they made a lot of money and now she's following her dreams.
I have lived, the poverty level in San Francisco for a single person is 21,000 and I have lived on less than, but it's up to 14,000 a year. If you have brains and you're clever and you don't cheat, I don't believe in cheating and I don't believe in lying, you can do anything you want. So I never did tell you the quote. The quote is what you've done. You do what you love, and you don't worry about what other people say, and you don't worry about whether you're going to make money or anything. You just do what you love. The woods would be very silent if the only birds who sang were those who sang best. And I love that quote.
Wow.
And I do it. I mean, I'm not that great a comedian. I'm getting there, but I'm not. I'm better every year. I'm working on this as if it was a new career. I just started a little late. But yeah.
Well, I love your passion for comedy. So what happened before? So how many times were you married?
Just twice after that.
Okay, after the gay, yeah, I'm done.
But I was done. No relationship either.
Really?
No, no.
So were you just asexual your whole life? How did you?
Well, I wasn't. I was asexual actively. You know.
Wow. You must have been with some real schlubs.
Well, they were terrible. But I painted pictures and I wrote books. I painted pictures. I wrote books. I like men. I'm heterosexual. I like men. But I've always been afraid because I don't know how to pick them. And the other thing, the undercurrent of that show is that those two men I married were very like my father. But I only make one remark, so nobody... My father's very distant. I didn't know him. I had the sister and the mother. And the mother, I was not right. I was the kind she wasn't very proud of. You can go two ways in life. You can go two ways. You can say, oh, I'm not following the formula that I see, that I read about, and I'm not following the formula that everyone tells me, or the rest of the people in my group are doing. I am a failure. Or you can say, no, I'm not following it because I know there's something better. And I always knew there was something better. And I always knew that until I loved myself, no one would ever love me because I wasn't secure enough. I was too needy. And if you listen, this is on the air, if you listen to one of the comedians that we have talked about, he is extremely needy. And that blocks everything he does.
Yep. I know who you're talking about. Your life started in Toledo, Ohio, of all places. And
now,
then
just a minute. Toledo doesn't think it's of all places. Just a minute. Yeah, it was awful.
I played there a few times when I was starting out on the road. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Late 80s.
Oh, no. But John Denver says, I spent a week there one day. Yeah. I watched watching the buns rise in Toledo, Ohio.
When did you move to San Francisco?
Toledo, well... I went to the University of Michigan. Are you aware of what the University of Michigan? It's the Harvard of the Midwest.
Yeah.
I picked it because it was, you had to be smart to get in. And I wanted an intellectual base. But it turns out it was very, very avant-garde. And that's where I got that foundation of a lot of things. I mean, I like frivolous things too. I mean, that was when I learned about the joy of foreplay in the Arboretum. I also learned about you know, good wine and nice clothes. It wasn't just earning money and looking good to the neighbors. It was an enlarging your mind and knowing what was going on in the whole world. That was the University of Michigan that gave that to me. And then I went to Cleveland to teach. And then Tommy, the husband... took me to Harvard, to Boston. So I had 2 years in Boston. And Boston is, God, you can't beat Cambridge and Boston. I loved it.
Yeah.
And they had this, you'd go to the, what was it, the Commons, and you could see these shows for nothing. We'd go there early to get a seat, and we'd play bridge. I'm crap at bridge. I mean, it's another reason why he wanted to hit me. I always bid the wrong thing. But we would see Menotti. We'd see operas by Menotti, and we would see Arthur Miller, and we would see, my God. And I saw great plays. And plays, theater, teaches you about life. Theater is how you learn. Not in the books. Not in the textbooks. And one of the things I also learned was, well, see, there's a part of my life that they didn't talk about here. After the second husband, I applied to Stanford University. That got me to Palo Alto. But that also taught me about education. And what I learned is that education, you educate yourself. All those schools did for me, all they did is show me how to find out what I wanted. I would guarantee that it took you a little longer to find what you needed to do than it would have taken me, because I knew more resources. That's all. Nothing else. It's a status thing, these schools, and it's crap. And the amount of money that these children are spending on an education. There's a kid that told this joke, I can't use it, but it's so beautiful. He said, I majored in English, and then I did a master's in history, so I would be sure that when I graduated, I'd be totally unemployable. And that's college.
Right.
I learned more when I lived in the trailer park. I lived in the trailer park with what you would call trailer trash.
How do you go from Michigan, Cambridge, and Stanford to a trailer park?
I didn't have any money.
You spent it all on the education.
No, I didn't. No, it wasn't expensive then. I think it was $119 a semester at the University of Michigan. Mm. And then remember the automobile accident with the face sliced off?
Yeah.
My father sued the lady. I never would have. But my father sued the lady, and that money sent me to Stanford.
Wow.
That's what I...
What year was that car accident where your face got ripped off?
1963, because Kennedy was assassinated.
Right? Around the same time?
That was it. 1963, I was at Stanford.
Jesus, what a bad year that was.
Yeah, it was a bad year. It was a bad year. The accident was before then. The accident was when I was... let's go back. The accident was I don't want to get the hospital mixed up with the accident. The accident was, I'm 27. I was 27. Because the line I said was, I'm 27 years old and my life is over, when I found out what they did to me. Because, I mean, my face came off. There was no safety glass. I have a scar. You can't see it anymore. It's been there forever, but it goes all the way back in there. Because he had to attach the ear again.
Holy shit.
You get through it. How many bad things have happened to you? And everyone says, oh, holy shit. You got through it.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
What other big life lessons have you learned like that?
Life lessons. I've learned that we all... it's so idealistic. Everybody that's listening is going to throw up. But I've learned that I don't believe in fear. I don't believe that people are evil. I believe people are basically good. I couldn't have gotten where I've gotten if people didn't help me. You saw what happened at the door. I just found that.
I know. The neighbor walked you to the door.
Right.
You know, it's funny, see, because I'm looking out this window.
Waiting to see.
Because Teviot Dale Place... It's weird because it says it on the side of the building. So you think this, and we did it when we arrived. We had all of our luggage and we go to that door because we thought that was Teviot Dale Place. And the woman is like, no one's there. And we're like, no, this is where we're staying for the month. And
yeah,
we flipped out.
Yeah.
And then we realized it was one street over.
That's right.
So everyone who's come to visit me has gone. So I'm sitting here watching you, waiting to see you pop up on this wrong street.
And yeah,
then,
I did.
And then the neighbor.
But she'd walk me over. This happens to me all the time because I trust. When Sarah Louise Young directed my show, and she wanted to get across, that the man that helped me in Winnie, Louisiana, could have taken me home and raped me, but he didn't. But I had absolutely no thought that he was going to do anything at all. He said, "I'm going to help you." I said, "Fine."
That was in your story in the show.
When I had the fifth wheel, I was going the fifth wheel. And I slammed on the brakes, and it was after the accident when I say, and live I did. But it didn't take 9 years. That's the thing. I have learned, that's an important life lesson. I've learned to take responsibility for myself and for my health. You've got to. Nobody knows how you feel or what you want in life better than you do. I always hate when some mother or father says to their 16-year-old, you don't know what love is. They do. They do.
Yeah.
It changes, but they do. I've learned that people are basically good. People, if they're evil and I remember the name of the jerk that was so horrible to me. I don't want to put his name on here either. He's basically an insecure person. When you're insecure and you're frightened,
this is a comedian?
Comedian, it was awful. Yeah. He wanted Molly to get me off the bill.
Oh, Molly, you told me that
it.
Story.
Yeah, Molly wouldn't do it.
Wow.
And God love Molly.
Molly Schmink.
Yeah, Schminky. Molly Schminky. She's my hero. But that's an insecure person. Because if somebody, each of us has our own life, but it's ours. And I guess I'm a flaming liberal, I guess. And I believe that everybody, when I used to teach, I taught college for a while, and I used to say to them, there is no wrong. And then one of my students said, yes, there is, because when I say something, you say, yes, but. And I was like, but there's always another side and another side and another side. And I believe that every dream is worth pursuing. And I believe that you get an idea, because my idea was just to travel around the country and write for Reader's Digest. I don't think they ever read any of the stories. They said they would. The guy's name was Phil, the editor. But my dream was to be a best-selling writer. After I gave up the idea of being the Mother Earth, I decided I would be a best-selling writer. I went to Stanford. I was going to write for every magazine in the whole. And that was when I found out that it all was so much garbage. You go to Stanford, and Stanford says, we will find you a job. But in essence... all the prejudice, all the hang-ups, all the things we think we've suppressed are right there. And you have to realize that that's part of living. If you don't realize that, you can't cope. If you've been so sheltered and so cared for, that's why I feel sorry for rich people. I don't feel that sorry for them, you know? But I do, because they've never had to struggle. They've never had to be diplomatic and political to get what they want. And what you want isn't a bad thing. That's good. I don't think that's selfish. So that's what I've learned. But I believe it.
Wow.
And I've lived it.
So when did you start having aspirations to be an entertainer? What was your life like?
You know, I'm thinking about this, and I always loved being the one on stage for the entertainments. You know, I always loved doing that. I didn't try out for plays or anything, but I always loved, like, we would have crazy sorority entertainments where we'd sing. You know, I was a teapot. I used to make up, there was an ad, I dreamt I something in my maiden form bra, and I used to make up little ditties about that. I was always good at parodies, that kind of thing.
You know,
but I never actually... I never even thought about performing. And then,
so when did you start being a comedian? Was what, in your 70s, right?
Yes, 71. But I also do cabaret and I strip. I can't right now, but I strip. I don't strip, but I strip. And I'm the stripping granny. If you look it up, you'll see. I'm the stripping granny.
I told you, did you ever see me do that bit about Germany where late at night on television there's these, you know, like in Europe, you've seen there'll be commercials with girls in bikinis and lingerie, and there's a 900 number you can call and talk dirty to a girl. They have that in Germany, but interspersed with the young hot girls or old grandma age.
Oh, you talked about that.
In the 70s, right? So, I mean, you could go to Germany. You could be like a pinup girl over
there. No, but I'm Jewish.
Damn it. Damn it.
Anybody give me a bar of soap, I'm leaving. That's it. No, I don't want to take the chance. Yeah. Here's a bar of soap. Daniel Kaner said he did his Jewish Chronicles in Berlin, and he says, I don't believe he did it, but he says he always gets up when he starts the Jewish Chronicles, which is songs. He always gets up and says, are there any Jews in the audience? Because he wants them to sing with him. So when he went to Berlin, he said, are there any Jews left? But from what I understand, they're very, very self-conscious about that. And that's another thing that everybody will disagree with and want to kill me for. Germany suffered terribly in the war. Terribly. Inhumanly. I don't feel that's right. I feel that we have not given them the sympathy they deserve. They were supporting your government. Because I remember what it was like in World War II. Nobody questioned what the United States was doing. We were pretty stinko too. But we all thought we were right. Well, the Germans thought they were right too.
Right.
I mean, The idea of trying to annihilate a race is, to me, sort of taking it a little too far. But at the same time, they really believed they needed to do that. Animal Farm. That was just what that's
some
about.
Some animals are more evil than others, yeah.
Yeah, they're convinced that others were the enemy. A friend of mine from Germany told me that she thinks that airport security now is just like what the Gestapo did, and I believe it. They create a fictional enemy, then they tell us that they are protecting our rights by limiting our freedoms. That's just what they're doing when we try to fly in an airplane. I weigh 98 pounds, and I'm taking off my shoes in case I have explosives in my shoe. By the time I bent down to get it, everybody would be out of the plane. You know, what's she doing? I know it's in there somewhere. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. And it's the amount of money that they are spending on the war against drugs, which I also don't believe in. When people want to escape, they're going to find a way. And the war against everybody else. They would take that money and they would use it to feed the hungry and educate. There's our utopia.
What else do you think is wrong with the United States and the world right now?
The United States is so solipsistic. The United States thinks that everything it knows the way. I mean, it thinks it's Jesus. And Jesus never had that kind of hubris. Jesus was much more modest than the United States. The United States says, we know how to govern. We're going to go in there and show you. We have the answer. We have the best of this, the best of that. No, they don't. They don't have the best of humanity. But I don't know who does, really, Tom. I mean, I thought it was here. Because I think the NHS is the most humane thing ever.
Yeah, it kills me when Americans talk bad about, like, oh, I have a friend in England or Canada and they say their healthcare is terrible.
Oh my God,
and they have to
wonderful.
Stand in line. But it's like it's always that fictional friend in Canada or in England. Oh, I have a friend that lives over there.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I've known you my whole life. You don't know anyone in fucking England or Canada. You know?
No,
I've heard people in my family say, oh yeah, I have a friend. No, you don't.
No, what about this? When I went to the National Institutes of Health, which is also free, my mother wouldn't talk to me because I went to a charity hospital. I went into NHS. The place was filled. This is when I had to have the cast recast. The place was filled. Every seat was filled. And this woman came out to reassure, because they triage, and mine wasn't that important, to reassure us, and actually called my name and said, you're not forgotten. I went in at 8:45. At 9:45, I was taken care of.
Well,
now, if I were bleeding, from what I understand, if you're actually bleeding, they take you right away. There's no, you just get in there. They've been
not like the United States. I mean, I busted.
You can lie there and hemorrhage.
I busted my head open in Philadelphia on January 2nd. You've seen, I told you that story.
No.
I was drunk.
You weren't.
Fell off of a bar stool.
Oh.
And I got 6 stitches right here, and I got 5 staples on the top of my head.
Oh, my God, when? Just
January 2nd this year. That's what made me stop drinking.
You stopped?
Yeah, completely. So I fall down. I fall off this stool. I'll try and give you the shortest version of the story.
No, yeah.
But I had January 1st off, and I go and have a couple beers. I'm by myself. Ashna was in Holland visiting her mother. And I don't give 2 shits about college football or very much sports at all. But the Fiesta Bowl was on. The University of Central Florida is playing. My brother went there. He's got season tickets. I knew he was at the game. I thought, you know what? I'm going to sit down and enjoy the UCF. Watch this game. Oh, and then this kid who went to my high school was the quarterback. Mm-hmm. So I watched the game. It was a great game. UCF won. I had 10 pints. Very normal. Ah. Very normal evening. Very normal evening. 10 pints. And I'm texting my brother. Great game. Love you, bro. And I just blacked out and I fell off this stool and my head hit the ground. Once my head hit the ground, I was wide awake. Some guy's lifting me up and he goes, we got to call an ambulance. And I go, fuck that. I don't have health insurance. Don't you dare call an ambulance.
Oh,
and he goes, you got to get to a hospital. And I said, how far is the nearest hospital? He goes, 2 blocks. I go, 2 blocks and you were going to call an ambulance? That's like 15 grand.
No, that's right.
In the States. So I walked and then my head, I'm bleeding. I took napkins from the bar. So I walked.
You're kidding. You walked. I have a story like that.
I walked like John Wayne, two blocks with holding the thing on my head. And I was bleeding. And there was no one else bleeding in the emergency room.
And they made you wait how long?
3 hours.
That's inhumane.
Yeah. I had to wait 3 hours before then, I was even seen.
And then.
And the whole thing cost me.
They charged you?
I think I had to pay $6,000 for 5 staples and 6 stitches. Yeah.
They charge you.
So I agree with you that the NHS is a great system.
The United States is inhumane.
And fuck the United States.
That's right.
I paid top dollar on the barrel head for my services, and I had to wait for people. There's people in there.
Do you do know that the insurance company, had you been insured, would not have paid that much?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, you better know that, too.
Oh,
there are animals there. That being human in this country, and I think in Sweden, which I don't understand because everybody in Sweden is killing themselves. I don't know why they're bothering. Because being human gives you a right. That, by the way, is the other thing I believe. Being human gives you a right. I have a huge...
What do you mean? Gives you a right to what?
Gives you a right to all kinds of things.
Rights and basic health care?
Basic health care gives you a right to shelter. If you get pregnant... Haven't you ever heard my joke? I love my joke. If you get pregnant here, you get a two-bedroom... Remember this. You get pregnant, you get a two-bedroom flat, and you get $1,200 a month if you're single.
Really?
Yes, you do. So I thought, well, you know, I could use a flat. So Frodo McDaniel said, yeah, but if you got pregnant, you wouldn't need the money because you'd have your own reality show. But the point is, they do that. Because if you're going to have crime, part of the reason you have crime is because children were not brought up properly. And there is no properly. Love is what it's all about. See, you have to see my second show, which you're not going to have time to see. And it's not that great right now.
Tell me the point.
7:15.
Tell me the point of it here.
The point of it is exactly that. You being who you are, you have a right as a human being to love, to creature comforts. That's your right.
Don't bang the table too much. It drives the listener crazy.
I mean, and I believe that.
Did you ever read the book Freakonomics? The guy did a study, and studied lots of different things and effects on society. And one of them was that after abortion was legalized in the United States, that violent crimes went down because less unloved children were being brought into the world.
Oh, so, my God, that's absolutely right.
So that a lot of violent crime in America went down just because, you know...
When they allowed abortion?
Because children that were not going to be loved were not being produced.
Well, see, no, I happen to believe in abortion rights. I believe that women, that you... Anna Quinlan says once the government starts legislating against women's bodies, the whole coat hangers come out. Yeah, I believe in that, but then we were having a big thing about father's rights. What about the guy? What if he wants the baby? I don't know. See, that's really making me think. Because that's got my two beliefs.
I went through that with that experience with a girl a long time ago.
Yeah?
She aborted a child I wanted to have. And it destroyed me.
What about your rights?
But, in the end, I'm glad it didn't happen.
So. Well, I'm glad I don't have babies now, but my God, I wanted them. You remember my show when my uncle called me? If he called me 2 days before, I'd still be married to that guy.
Why?
Because he said, I have a baby, and I would have taken the baby, and I wouldn't have let Tommy leave. Because I wanted a baby. Because Tommy, what happened is he left, but I let him. I mean, I didn't fight at all. I said,
adios, AMF.
Yeah.
Adios, motherfucker.
Yeah, go. But that's amazing with the healthcare in America, but it's also the justice system. I don't know whether you're aware of the justice system, how horrible it is.
Oh, the police... my father was killed by a drunk driver who was a rich guy who got off.
No, that's right.
I'm fully aware of how meaningless.
Money. Oh, yeah, the justice system doesn't
work. I always thought America had problems, and I always thought America was fucked up in certain ways, but I always believed in our judicial system, which I no longer...
Don't.
If you have money, you can get away with fucking murder.
What about that little black guy, that innocent little black guy that was walking, what was it, Trevor or Trevam or something, walking with a Coke or something?
Trayvon Martin.
Yes.
Sanford, Florida.
I'm still angry about that.
Yeah, me too. I'm from Oviedo, Florida, which is in the same county.
I would think...
He had a bag of Skittles. and then Arizona iced
because
tea.
He fought back. This guy said, "What was his name?" The guy. Ugh. He said,
"George
he said,
Zimmerman." Well,
yeah, he said, Look, I've got scars. I've got, you know, the guy hit me. He hit him because he fought back because he was smart enough to hit back. And by the way, the guy was, now he's taken in because he did something else. He did something else horrible.
Yeah, well, but, he hit his wife. He's been arrested for gun possession.
But that makes no difference. He shot that little kid.
He did. He murdered that kid.
And that little kid has no life anymore because of him. And that's the other thing I get upset about. The parents could have sued and probably wanted to sue for millions and millions of dollars, but that doesn't bring the kid back. We have to get back to the source of that, to give these sick fucks power. That's where we have to go. But America doesn't do that. If you have money, you suddenly become important. And if you, and the police, you go, yeah, I'm so angry, I'm gonna break the table. The police carry guns. And you know, every time they shoot someone, they never are convicted, ever, ever. There's a big brouhaha, and they're never convicted. So I'm not really that happy with America, and it's a sad thing, because remember, my family was Jewish, and we came over. It was the land of plenty. It was where we were going to find our dream. And they did it for my family. My grandfather was a plasterer. My other grandfather was a kosher butcher, fundamentalist, really, really religious. And they made their fortune, but I don't think they made a life. I think we're on a better road, and I love it here, but I haven't done the travel that you've done.
Why did you move over here?
It was an accident. Oh,
because I mean, did you?
I lost my house
in Pacifico.
I got the mortgage scam.
What, like people? Hey, get a double mortgage,
a triple mortgage, and triple. Then I couldn't pay for it, and then I clicked on a link that said, "We will save your home," and it was a real estate agent. So when I filled out all the papers for the government help, which, by the way, I don't believe in, but I filled out all the papers, they never sent them in. And then when I came back from Mexico, I did comedy in Mexico. I don't know if you've done comedy in Mexico. I can't stand sweating. I'll never go back there again. But anyway, I came back, and I get this notice on my door, "Hello, you're being foreclosed." And I called the people that were supposed to help me save my home. And they said, "Well, your only choice now is a short sale." And within a half an hour, they had all the papers filled out, because they'd had them filled out before. And she had the house, she had an open house the next week, and she had buyers, because they had been advertising this while I was gone. So I was sort of...
So you were swindled out of your house.
Yeah.
Wow.
But...
And it's always those mortgage scams. They're always preying on older people.
Yeah, right. And I'm a target.
Because my mom in Florida gets offers all the time, you know, for that kind of stuff.
How's she doing?
She hasn't fallen for it. She's doing okay.
Yeah, but see, if you're smart, how many kids does she have?
Four. Well,
and are you all savvy?
One's dead, but three now. Yeah, my sister died of breast cancer.
You told me that.
Yeah. Had a tough couple years there. Mm. Thank God for comedy, Lynn Ruth.
Yeah, right. No, I'm telling you, yes.
You're a survivor, you know what it's like. And I mean, I see the original energy of joy in your face when you're performing.
Oh, I was so, yeah.
You know, and one thing I want to point out to you, I thought was really beautiful when I came and saw you perform the other day. And it's the great thing about the Fringe, you know, you see like how many seats does your room hold? 60?
Yeah.
You're giving the show your life. Oh. And the place holds 60 people. And the thing that really... I thought was a Norman Rockwell painting, or just a sight of beauty for me, was there were young women in there riveted to your life story. And there was even one woman who had her face painted up. She was obviously a performer who had to go to a show immediately after yours. And she had, I guess it was like, it wasn't like clown makeup. It was like, but it was
that white
some
stuff.
Kind of white face makeup. Like she was an angel or something.
Remember.
And she was just fucking riveted, as was all the women. And then like older women, like 30, 40, 50s level. I mean, I could see them wiping tears back, you know,
because they are afraid to try. What do you have to lose? I mean, I figure, what do I have to lose? And my dream is valid. Your dream is valid. Everybody's dream is valid. And you're living, I don't know how close you were to your sister, But I had my roommate in college, not the one that married the rich guy, but the other one. She died of breast cancer when she was in her early 50s. She was, because Gloria was just 2 years older than I. And I was 48 when I moved into the house. No, it's 48 when I went to Cal. I was 52. When I moved into the house, I was something like 50 to 52. And Gloria died that year. And I've always said, I'm living the life that she would have wanted to live.
Hmm.
That's the message of the 7:15 show, is you do your dream, you live the life. All my stuff is very Pollyanna, but it's Pollyanna with a different slant. It's Pollyanna because I've done it.
What's Pollyanna mean?
Pollyanna means super saccharine sweet. That's a book that you didn't read because you weren't a little girl. All little girls read Pollyanna. She just believed that everything was nice and flowers will bloom and the sun will come out and God is good and woohoo. And I believe that basically we are good. I know it sounds silly. I mean, you've heard my humor. My humor is very, it's very acid.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, I was surprised when I saw your show and you're talking about this. Wow, there's all this stuff in your life that had happened to you. Because like you're in your comedy, you never, it's all pow, pow, pow. And yeah. I love jokes. So I love
jokes too. Yeah.
You know, here's this older woman up there friggin' hitting the heavy bag, shall we say. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
No. Pow, here's another one in your gut. Pow.
That's what jokes are. But jokes they always have a flavor of reality. They always have a little thing behind them that's real. And one of the things that's absolutely horrible, I pick on old men, but old men, I really don't mean it. But what it is what they cannot, older people cannot, after they're 60, they cannot believe that their life changes. And all the things they wanted when they were 20 to 60, they don't really want anymore. They just think they should want. And that's why STDs are up in the old age homes.
Oh, yeah, like the Viagra and yeah. Florida, all those, you always hear about these old right, retirement communities that STDs are going crazy.
Yeah, it's like mad because they don't real. And I'm telling you, after a certain age, sex is pretty crappy. It's you don't need to do it every night because it's not worth it. Better a book, right?
What is the greatest book you ever read?
Oh,
or one
of
your favorites?
My favorite is God of Small Things. God of Small Things, and I never can remember her name. It's written by an Indian lawyer, and everything else she's written is political and political treatises. This is God of Small Things. I read it, turned it over, and read it again. It's about the prejudice between the Pakistani and the Indian people, and this woman that has an affair with a Pakistani, and it's seen through these two children's eyes, her twins. And nothing's ever affected me like that. Valley of Decision was also another one. That was about,
Valley of Decision?
Yeah, that's about the coal mines in Pennsylvania and how they exploit people. But God of Small Things, why can't I remember her name? Roy is her last name.
I remember that book. I never read it. I remember when it came out.
I read it, and then I turned it over and read it again. I've read it 4 times now.
Is there anything good about old age?
Everything.
Yeah?
Everything.
Because it seems so dreaded in our society, and we worship youth culture, mm-hmm. and I mean, even, older people are pushed out of society, you know, you have to go live in these homes. You are a fighter, and you are a survivor, and you are living like someone in their 20s. You're like me in my 20s in that... You're following your dream. And you know what? Fuck it. I'll move to England. I'll be a comedian over there.
Yeah, why not? Yeah.
So, I mean... Yeah.
Everything is good about it. The only thing that's hard for me is looking in the mirror. Because I am a Jewish materialist deep down inside. And I like beautiful clothes and I like to look beautiful. And this is not beautiful to me. And even though I taught the humanities and I said to people, what you look like is only matters for that first instant. We know each other now. You see who I am. I mean, you also see the wrinkled face, but you see who I am. It's a different kind of beauty. And I've always said that beauty lasts forever. But I still look in the mirror and don't like what I see. That's the only problem.
Well, I can relate to that. I look in the mirror and go, who's that old fucking guy?
Yeah, see, we do it.
So if I'm getting, if I, and I've been feeling that way since probably 35. Mm. So, If I feel that way, I could only imagine how you feel at 81.
Oh, my God, terrible. I look and I see and the 8 spots. I've got the brown spots here and the figure. And, you know, for me, especially with this insane thing of being thin, the idea that I've got a crazy shape and that bothers me. But I know that it's superficial. And I know when I finished that show, I said exactly what I meant. I've got so much I'm going to do. You've given me a list of names. I'm carrying that around in my purse. As soon as I have 2 hands, I'm contacting those people. And most of them will ignore me. They think that at 81, I'm a gimmick. But there'll be one that'll say, yeah, maybe. And I'll go out and I'll do all these things. I want to explore the continent. I'm going to Australia. I'm going to Melbourne for sure next year. I'm taking my pension. And now I have a job. I'm a TV presenter. And I'm coming to see you in London. But when you're back, on the 30th, I think it is.
Soho Theater, 29th and 30th.
29th, 30th. Well, I've got you down for the 30th, and I'm taking Cecilia, that gorgeous little girl that looks Sicilian. She's actually from something like Liverpool or something. Someplace awful. But she looks like a hot Sicilian. Remember?
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
But I want you, when you're back the next time, I want you to come and I want you to do a show in Brighton. And by that time...
Why did you choose Brighton?
Brighton chose me. After I...
Because, I mean, Brighton is like the San Francisco of England. Right. So, I mean, you go from San Francisco to San Francisco. I mean, I love Brighton. I haven't been there probably in 10 years. Oh, but
it's gotten better.
But Brighton is absolute coolsville. Mm-hmm. So why did you choose there?
They have a festival. And the first year I did the festival, I did a cabaret called Aging is Amazing. That was one where this old lady old age home. I know, she's in an old age home, and she's on the entertainment committee. And it won Star of Brighton. It won Best of Brighton. And the guy that runs the thing that gives the prizes saw my show 2 years later when I did it with Carol Cleveland. You know who Carol Cleveland is?
Mm-hmm.
She's the sex symbol in the Monty Python. The Monty Python series?
Yeah.
The sex symbol, the hot blonde?
Okay.
That's Carol Cleveland. She's 70. So she was doing her show, Pom Poms Up, which is not her best. And and she wanted me to do Aging is Amazing. And Bill Smith, the guy that runs the latest magazine, the latest music bar, saw it. And he said, you should take the best of what you've done and put it together with some production and then put it on, and that's Granny's Gone Wild. That's my 7:15 show.
Hmm.
And I'm not that fond of it, so I'm not that worried. I'm not that bothered that you don't see it. The one I want you to see is a thing called 80, and it'll be here, I hope, next year, because it's more real. But he put it together, and he paid for the venue last year, and the thing won Best Cabaret.
Yeah, what was the award you won in Edinburgh last
year? I won the one that Lady Rizzo won the year before.
It's for Best Cabaret Show?
Yeah. Wow. There's no comparing us. I work on no budget whatsoever. She's got a band and a costume and a voice.
It shows you what a badass performer you are.
God love you. That is very sweet. I'm reality.
All the evidence indicates that God does indeed love me.
Yeah, you know that. Isn't that funny because I'm an atheist? If you're a born-again Christian, you'll have to convince me. I'm an atheist.
I didn't realize also in your show, I didn't realize your history with Edinburgh, that you've been coming here for, 9 years?
Oh, much longer. I've been coming to the festival for 9 years.
Performing.
I started out with a thing called Weapons of Laugh Destruction. And it was a terrible show. And I brought 4.
You are good at titles.
Yeah.
You are great at titles.
Yeah. My television show, the best title I've ever done is the book review program, which is called What's Hot Between the Covers. I've never been able to beat that one. What's Hot Between the Covers. Yeah, I'm good at titles. So that was Weapons of Laugh Destruction, and I brought comedians from San Francisco, and I called Hartley Kemp, who runs C Venues, and I said to him, how would you like comedy from San Francisco? And he thinks I'm bringing people like Johnny Steele and what's his name that just died, Robin Williams,
right.
And I'm bringing Yaini Ababa And I forget the woman's name, but she was crap. Sharman Bacigalupi. Do you remember her?
Mm-mm.
Oh, Sharman Bacigalupi. Someone said to her, "Is that your stage name?" She said, she later divorced him. Now it's Sharman Summers. Sharman Bacigalupi. But I brought George Corrigan. I brought them all here, and we split the cost. And that was when I started the stripping. And that was in 2005.
Just to pay for the bills.
No. Because Oxford, no, I never have made, no.
It's an old American
decision. You haven't seen the stripping. But you would love it because it's a, the stripping is making fun of these women that think, A, that taking off their clothes empowers them. And I must tell you what Frodo McDaniel said because I love it. He said, people say that when you take off your clothes and begin to dance, you twirl your tits, that you are empowered. And Frodo McDaniel says, if I want to see a frightened woman take off her clothes, I'll bring a gun. I love that.
Wow.
I'm not going to go to a strip team. I think that it's reducing ourselves to objects, and I don't think we're objects. We're people with minds. Minds and hearts. I mean, I'm thrilled that you did see the show, but you have always been more than a comedian to me. When I called you and said, would you do Stanford? I mean, I paid you peanuts, whatever it was. But that you did, those kids still remember that.
I got to play Stanford. I was thrilled.
That was nothing compared to them. They were absolutely elated. They had an international comedian.
One of a few of those people that were at that show still stay in touch with me.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, that I've sent emails. I remember I had talked about, at the time I was going through the breakup with the Dutch girl. So this this is 10 years ago. And I remember this girl, and it showed the intelligence of people that go to Stanford. This girl sent me this really long email the very next day after the show. And she said, you know, I could feel your pain in your humor. And that it was real.
Yeah, that's Stanford.
And she goes, I want you to know that I watching your show, I think you're a really quality person, and you have a great sense of humor, and that you're going to find love one day.
And you did?
Fucking cried.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's Stanford. I love that school. I really loved it. It was different than the others.
Who would send a comedian a message like that the next day? It's just,
God. She heard it.
So beautiful.
And what I remember is that you did that for those kids. I got Johnny Steele down there, but it was like pulling teeth, but I got him down there too. And those children never forgot it. That was... Because they're eggheads and they don't communicate well with the established world. And you were part of that, even though you're not, because you were a comedian they read about.
Well, if Stanford University wants me to teach a course in stand-up comedy,
they would love it.
I'm ready.
And do you know they would love it?
I need a place to live.
Yeah, you'd love Palo Alto. Oh, you'd love Palo Alto. Yeah.
Hey, so we don't have too much time left. The... show I was going to see, there was a show here that had old Jewish jokes, and you said, we won't say the person's name, and you said,
I tell better jokes.
Yeah, let's hear your better Jewish jokes.
Well, you know, I'm seeing a lot, one of the ones I absolutely love is this little Jewish couple, they're about in their 90s, and she goes upstairs to get ready for bed, and then she leans downstairs and she says, Jakey, when are you going to come upstairs and make love to me? And he says, I don't think I can manage both. And I have heard a lot of people use that joke, but that's a Jewish joke. And the other one I love is, I love Leo Rostam. But the cross-eyed... Leo Rostam. Jesus, you've got to read him. He's from Florida. Huh. He's a little Jewish guy. This one, I think, maybe you'll laugh. A lot of Jewish people always laugh at this. Jewish people always laugh at that. It's the cross-eyed judge. The cross-eyed judge who says to the first witness, what's your name? The second guy says, John Smith. The judge says, I didn't ask you. And the third guy says, I didn't answer. That's, I find that extremely funny. I read that while I was on the underground at Stanford. I was on the whatever it is. Not Stanford, in San Francisco. I started laughing. That's a cross-eyed judge. That's Leo Rostam. That's also Tilly is pushing a carriage. And I can go on like this forever. He's pushing a baby carriage, and this other woman looks at, oh, Tilly, you've got triplets. That's a miracle. And she says, yes, it's a miracle. She says, the doctor says it only happens once in 30,000 times. And the other woman says, my God, Tilly, how did you have time to do the housework? That's Jewish. And then there's one, this Irish guy is using all the Jewish jokes. The circumcision thing, where there's two of them, where the guy is walking down the street, and always it's a little short guy with thick glasses, the guy that does the circumcision, he's called a Moyle, and he's reading the Talmud or whatever the hell he's reading. He's walking down the street. Out of nowhere, this guy runs up to him, throws his arms around him, and says, Rabbi, Rabbi, thank you, thank you. And the guy looks at him, he has no idea who he is. He says, for what? He says, it fits everybody. Yeah, that's the Moyle joke. Yeah. It's Leo
My
Wasserman.
Favorite Jewish joke, I'm sure you've heard it. Two old Jewish women are having lunch in a restaurant, and the waiter comes up and said, ladies, is anything
open? Right? Yeah. The Jewish waiter just forever, is anything right? The three men,
is anything
they
okay?
sit down, the three men sit down at to have tea. And in those days, the Russian tea is in a glass. Mm. So the first one says to the waiter, I would like a glass of tea. The second one says, I would like a glass of tea. And the third one says, I would like a glass of tea and make it a clean glass. And the waiter comes back with three glasses of tea and he says, which one ordered the clean glass? I always have. And the other one is a little Jewish man sitting at the table and he says, waiter, he says, come taste this soup. So the waiter says, well, what's the matter, sir? Is there something wrong with the soup? He says, just come taste the soup. He says, is there something? Can I bring, is the soup not hot enough? Just tell me, what is it? He says, just come taste the soup. He says, all right, I'll taste the soup. Where's the spoon? And the guy says, aha! That's also yeah, that's what we do. That's it. That's how I got into this.
Got it. Oh, did comedy is just...
I always have been good at this. I can keep going. You give me a subject and I'll start. A 99-year-old grandpa dies. She dies and the grandchild calls up grandma and says, I thought he'd make it to 100. I thought he'd get the letter. This is in America, a letter from the president. I thought he'd make it. She says, how did grandpa die? She says, it was the sex that killed him. She says, you're having sex with my grandpa and he's 99 years old? She says, yes. She said, on Sundays, because remember, they're Jewish. On Sundays, when all our neighbors went to church, we would do it in time to the church bells. Ding, and your grandpa went ding. Dong, and your grandpa went dong. And then she burst into tears. And she says, if it hadn't been for that for stinking ice cream truck, your grandpa would be alive today. Yeah, that's another one, right? And another one. 99-year-old man goes, so it's always a 99-year-old man goes to the doctor, and he says, I'm getting married. The doctor says, ooh, that's great. He says, yeah, and she's 22. I'll give you another one with that one, too. He says, she's 22. He says, the doctor says, yeah, are you planning to have sex? He says, yeah, of course I'm planning to have sex. He says, you know, that could be very dangerous. And the guy says, well, if she dies, she dies.
Classic.
And Sophie Tucker. You know Sophie Tucker. Sophie Tucker was talking to a friend, Ernie, and Ernie said, I have a girlfriend. He's the same age. And they're about 80. He says, Sophie, and Ernie says, I got a new girlfriend, Sophie. And she says, oh, really? He says, yeah, she's 25 years old. And Sophie says, oh, that's really nice. He says, yeah, and we're having a really good time. He said, oh, that's nice. She says, and I have a new boyfriend, too. And he's 25, too. And I want to tell you something, Ernie. 25 goes into 80 a lot easier than 80 goes into 25.
It's a mathematician. I've heard that. When you see like older guys in Asia with like young women, you go, oh, yeah, he's a mathematician. He's trying to see how many times 67 goes into 21.
Yeah, that's it. No, people use these, but they were originally.
They bend them, yeah. What is the greatest advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
Jimmy Gunn. Do you remember
Jimmy? I remember Jimmy Gunn. Yeah, Jimmy used to put Gunn. White face on his
Yeah. Jimmy face. Gunn said to me, your bread and butter is your stand-up Lynn Ruth. It's harder. You have more failures with it, but that's your bread and butter. Always remember that. I can write a joke as a comedian. Your bread and butter is writing that joke. So many of us don't. We get up there and riff, and that's a huge mistake. My new one is I never go out with any man that blushes because the blood is in the wrong place. You have to write.
I always say the answer to every problem is to write better jokes.
Yeah.
That has been the secret of my success. Just my formula.
Yeah,
so our taxi is about to arrive.
This has been
so you can make it to your show. Thank you for coming over to my little cottage in Stockbridge. In closing, is there any words of wisdom or advice that you have for the people of the earth?
The people, anybody?
Yeah.
Just figure out what your dream is and then go after it. And then, like Thoreau, build your castle in the air and then to build the steps that could lead to it. And if they take you a different road, grab that. Don't tell life what to give you. Take what life gives you and make it work.
Wow, it's beautiful.
True.
Very true.
And that's the point. It's true. And everybody says, if you don't have money, you can never do this. I've done all of this.
Yeah, I didn't have any money doing what I mean, you know, sometimes I had to save to get plane tickets to London and stuff like that, but I eventually got to do it. Always I mean, every good. all the big risks I ever took in my life was when I basically had no money in the bank. And the thing I love about you the most is you are a risk taker.
Oh yeah.
And the fact that at, you know, 80 years old, you're taking
a new job.
You're taking a risk like someone in their 20s.
But why not?
Yeah.
And you have to figure, listen, if it doesn't work out, I'll suffer a lot fewer years with my mistake.
Why be miserable in one place when, you know?
Yeah, never.
You could go, you know, be miserable somewhere with a nice view.
Yeah, that's right, with a nice view. No, it's life is good. I think maybe that's the message. Life is good. If it isn't, look to yourself. Life is good.
Life is good. I love you very much, Lynn Ruth Miller. Too. And long may you run, sister.